Move down a little bit. All right.
Well, let's go ahead and get started today. My name is Dennis Weibel, and on behalf of the Journalism School here and FEJ, I want to thank everyone for coming. We've got a great panel put together for you today to tell the story of Libby, Montana, one of America's worst community environmental disasters. Before I introduce you to them, I want to give you a little bit of background to the story, some broad facts that you can, if you're not familiar with what's happening in Libby, it can help you understand it. And I'll start with a quote. First it killed some miners. Then it killed wives and children, slipping into their homes on the dusty clothing of hardworking men. Now the mine is closed, but in Libby the killing goes on. With those words nearly 11 years ago, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer kicked off its series, told the nation of a disaster that had already killed scores of Libby residents and sickened hundreds more. For decades, the asbestos-laden dust, the byproduct of a vermiculite mine, had drifted over and through this logging town of 3,000 souls. It billowed from the miners' clothing, from the staging area where it was packaged and stored. It floated up from the high school track, from the gardens of people who used it as fertilizer. It leached from the insulation in homes and from their schools. It covered trees. The mine closed in 1990, but the dust lingered, doing its slow and relentless damage. The clouds on residents' x-rays foretold of the asbestosis, lung cancer, and mesothelioma that would come. According to a recent update, a story written by Matthew Brown in the Associated Press, Libby's death toll now stands at more than 400. 1,500 people now show signs of asbestos-related scarring, and at the town's asbestos clinic, new cases continue to be diagnosed at a rate of 15 to 20 cases a month. Physicians expect to be diagnosing those cases for at least another decade. Meanwhile, the cleanup lumbers on. When Libby was listed as a Superfund site in 2001, EPA officials thought it would take 2 years and cost just under $6 million. Nearly 10 years have passed, and the price tag stands at more than $330 million so far. And then there's a matter of justice. Plaintiff's victories in key lawsuits led to scores of settlements in key cases. And in 2008, after a long fight, Grace settled with the EPA for $250 million. But a federal prosecution of the company executives resulted in acquittals in a Missoula courtroom a year ago last spring. Those are the broad facts of the case. We've assembled a good panel of experts to flesh that out and tell you why Libby matters today. You'll find more full bios of them in conference literature, but let me introduce them in the context of the Libby story and why they're here today. First off, I'd like to introduce Andrew Schneider. He's a two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter who wrote Libby's story for the Seattle PI 11 years ago. Those are his words I started with today. He went on to document that the disaster in his book, The Air That Kills, the Asbestos Poisoning of Libby, Montana, how the asbestos poisoning of Libby, Montana uncovered a national scandal. Andrew has worked for major news organizations across the country, and today he's a senior public health correspondent at AOL. You'll also find his work at coldtruth.com. Andrew King Reese is a professor at the University of Montana School of Law. In 2009, he and journalism professor Nadia White led a team of law and journalism students who provided gavel-to-gavel legal analysis and news coverage of the U.S. government's criminal prosecution of W.R. Grace executives. He's perfectly suited to tell you what happened in that trial. We also have with us Gregory Meeker, a geologist for the U.S. Geological Survey. He testified in the Grace case and on asbestos issues before Congress. He's an expert on the mineralogy of asbestos and on the controversy over how it should be described and regulated, a subject of great contention in the Grace trial itself. We also have with us Tony Ward, a professor and air quality expert at UM's Center for Environmental Health Sciences, and his research includes studies about asbestos contamination in the trees in and around Libby and the surprising potential for future contamination from logging and burning. And last, but by no means least, is Gayla Benefield, on our panel today, who knows Libby's agony better than anyone. Her outrage drove the story long before the first words were written. and she still drives it today, despite the anger and complacency of those who wish it would just go away. She is intimately familiar with the human toll in Libby. Asbestos claimed both of her parents, and her daughter was diagnosed in May. With that, I want to start our panel presentations. They're going to make some brief comments, and then we'll get to your questions as soon as we can. But I'd like to introduce first Andrew Schneider to tell you about what Libby means today for him.
You ever think about a story that would just never go away, that just lingers forever? So in the 11 years since the PI first broke the Libby story, we've done over 340 stories on Libby and asbestos. It continues today. Here I am, 13 interviews into yet another story that deals with Libby. It's a concern that I have that it will never stop. The issue of asbestos itself is really important, and I'm sure everybody in this room understands that asbestos is not banned in this country. We are one of the few industrialized countries that haven't outlawed it. Patty Murray and Barbara Boxer tried really hard to get legislation passed. The law as written was really comprehensive. It would have been extremely protective. And then somewhere between the signature of the law on the bill and its passage, it changed. It was watered down. And many of the protective factors in that bill were just gutted out. So basically, it's a law that means very little today. The battle over asbestos permeates almost every state. A state senator in California decided, as a gesture to a group of asbestos victims advocates, to try to change the state rock of California, which is serpentine, which is a asbestos-containing mineral, as Greg will undoubtedly tell you. It seemed innocuous enough. It didn't mean anything. It just meant perhaps we should realize that asbestos is still killing hundreds of thousands in this country and elsewhere. Well, the defense lawyers didn't see it that way, and they threw up this enormous blockade to keep this innocuous bill from being passed. And their fear was, if it actually was passed, all of the lawyers, all of the trial lawyers bringing litigation would immediately point to, look, California outlawed this rock. It's no longer there. So, I mean, this is the kind of activity that's going on in all levels. There are still many products on the market that contain asbestos. We are still importing them. There's a level of increasing discussion on how much is too much. That's always been an issue with asbestos. It was an issue with Libby. It's an issue today with how much is harmful. There is no known threshold, no point below which it's considered safe. Yet, everyone wishes to argue about it and not get to the science, mainly because you've got this enormous litigation, this ocean of litigation going on, and any effort that would be made could be used, it is believed, to bolster the arguments of either the prosecution or the defense in these cases. So basically, we're going nowhere.
Andrew King Reese is here to talk about the criminal trial that ended a year ago last spring. And we'd like you to tell us sort of about the outcome of that trial and maybe explain its significance and what happened.
I think that's a lot to say. I think what's interesting is, one, that we had a criminal trial, and then two, the outcome of that criminal trial is pretty fascinating, because I think American society is so, our history is really very legal, and we often turn to the court systems to resolve major social issues. So often we think about, well, there was a criminal trial, or there was a trial, and therefore we got some resolution, or we made some progress. As a former prosecutor, when journalists would say defendant was found innocent, I always struggle with that sentence, because not guilty to me is not the equivalent of innocent. It just meant the state didn't meet its burden of proof. I think the state was courageous in bringing the trial in the first instance. It was an unusual trial, massive scope. Talking about the charge of conspiracy that went back 30 years. The state had an uphill battle, or the U.S. government had an uphill battle in this prosecution, because, as Andrew mentioned, the Clean Air Act was enacted in 1990. The mill shut down in 1990. So it wasn't criminalized. In other words, the release of asbestos was not criminalized until 1990. Grace had already shut down the mill. The government then was precluded from dealing with all of the exposure that took place prior to 1990. And that exposure was enormous. Because the exposure that took place after 1990 really is a result of the things that took place before 1990. In other words, Grace would put their piles of vermiculite out, and people could take it. They could take it home and put it in their gardens because it made their gardens grow better. They could play in it. They could do all kinds of stuff. Grace put it all over the community in an effort to be a good, you know, community citizen. Unfortunately, from the government's perspective, what Grace forgot to tell everybody was what they knew about their own product, was it was particularly deadly. And, I mean, everybody knows asbestos is deadly. You talked about, everybody understands, and the difficulty in the regulation is a separate issue. Everybody understands its deadly nature. What W.R. Grace knew was that it had a particularly deadly variety of asbestos, and they had done lots and lots of research on how deadly it was, on trying to contain its deadliness, and had failed in all those efforts. And they failed to disclose a lot of that information. That was the government's theory, that they defrauded the government by not disclosing that information. But as I said, the government was really in this weird time frame, and they had a struggle because the court said you have to have releases after 1990 that actually put somebody in danger of serious bodily injury or death. Well, that denies really the science, I think, if we talk about asbestos exposure and the latency period. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to think about, I went out of my garden on Tuesday and I turned the soil and therefore I got asbestos in my lungs on Tuesday and that was what really pushed me over and that's why I have asbestosis today. That's not the way asbestos exposure works. And the difficulty the government had was trying to fit into the legal constraints. In a nutshell, they were unable to do that. And I think when you followed the trial really closely, you began to see that the legal story and the sort of broader social narrative really diverged, and the government was fighting an uphill battle the whole time. Does that mean they shouldn't have done it? Was that a waste of resources? I don't think so. I think hopefully what that says is they'll learn from this trial, move forward, and maybe along with figuring out how to regulate asbestos or ban asbestos, the government could figure out how to learn from this trial. Maybe we could amend some of the laws that criminalize some of this conduct.
And Greg, could you tell us about this mineral and how it played out in Libby, and give it some shed some light perhaps on the regulation of it?
Yeah. I work for the USGS, U.S. Geological Survey, and we're the science agency for the Department of the Interior. And when EPA went up to Libby in late 1999, they came to us early in 2000 to help them try to understand what they were dealing with up there. And we have various analytical tools that we use to help them, and it became clear very early on that the mineral that we were dealing with up in the mine in Libby was different, and it became clear that it was going to be a very difficult communication challenge to talk about this material in relation to what everyone considered asbestos at the time. Asbestos is defined by its commercial properties, and the properties that flexibility, resistance to heat, resistance to chemicals, and that's why it was used in so many products for so long. Those definitions work very well when the regulators and the analytical laboratories looking at asbestos were dealing with the commercial material, because you know the definitions were based on those properties. Everyone knew what they were dealing with. It was just really a matter of identifying which one of the six regulated asbestos minerals you were dealing with. As it turned out, the mineral up in the mine at Libby was originally called tremolite, which is one of the six regulated asbestos minerals. But as geologists and scientists do, mineralogists in the 70s decided they were going to change the way minerals are defined, amphibole minerals. And amphibole is a broad class of mineral, and that's what's up in the mine, the asbestos mineral at Libby. They decided they were going to redo the nomenclature, change the way we name these minerals. And they weren't thinking about asbestos at the time. Amphiboles occur in a lot of different rocks, and mineralogists and geologists study them for a variety of reasons. And so they went ahead and changed the way we define these minerals. Well, before that time, the mineral in Libby had been called tremolite, or sodium-rich tremolite, and tremolite is a regulated asbestos mineral. After they changed the name, most of the material in the mine became or was assigned a different name. And people really didn't pay attention to this until 2000, when the EPA went up there and people started to go back and look at the mineral again. And you know, we were asked to study it, and we had to analyze it and report on it. And to do that, we had to use the current nomenclature, or else the American Mineralogist, the journal that we published in, would not have published the paper. And so when we said that, okay, according to the new terminology, this is now called, it's not called tremolite anymore, it's called, it's a mineral called winchite, everybody kind of freaked out. I mean, they didn't know, the regulators didn't know what to do with it, the medical, the health professionals didn't understand, so it became a very difficult communication challenge. And it turned out to be a very big issue in the trial, because of course the defense would take that information and say, how can these people be guilty, because this is not even a regulated material. But you know, if you think about it, if biologists got together and decided they were going to change the name of marijuana to something else, you know, and did that, would that mean that it would still be an illegal substance? I mean, that's really what happened. And so this has led to people really taking a new look at the definition of asbestos, and not only the names of the minerals, but the forms of the minerals, what the particles look like. And it's really become a big issue because of Libby. And people are now trying to understand what properties of these minerals are actually responsible for disease. There's a big effort down in North Carolina at EPA to study the amphibole from Libby, to try to understand its potency, why it's as potent as it is, what is there about it that might be different from other fibrous minerals. And so it's really caused the whole community to take a new look at how we define minerals, and you know, the medical folks, the regulators, the politicians, really take a new look at this issue and try to understand what we're dealing with.
Thanks. I want to bring Tony in to talk about the ongoing contamination, and the cleanup is still going on. In your own research, you're finding sort of the contamination in places where people probably didn't think they'd find it. And could you tell us about your research?
Yeah, so my lab began asbestos research back in 2003. And our original project was to do a feasibility study to see, is it safe to economically feasible to harvest the stands of trees within the mine site, within the Superfund site. So as part of that project, some collaborators of mine at Montana Tech, Julie Hart and Terry Spear, we developed this project. We went up to the mine site and collected some soil samples and some tree bark samples. And our original hypothesis was that when you chop down a tree on the mine site, which we thought was going to be clean, and you dragged it through contaminated soil, which EPA had shown that it was highly contaminated in that whole region, that's where the contamination for the tree would occur. So another collaborator of ours, Dr. Jim Weber at the Wadsworth Center in New York State Health Department, analyzed the samples for us, the soil samples, and they came up, lots of Libby amphibole, like you would expect, just like all the other samples. He didn't analyze the bark sample, and we needed that one piece of information as proof of principle that would support our firewood or our logging, commercial logging project. So after a couple of months of bugging him, he finally did it late on a Friday afternoon. And he called later on a Friday afternoon and said, you know, do we have to kind of redefine the game plan of investigating this? There's lots of Libby amphibole in the tree bark samples. So he analyzed a couple more samples, and the short of the story is that there is just massive contamination in the trees at the mine site at three different locations. So we dropped that study and immediately started thinking about, well, you know, what is the implications of this? What are the chances of exposure or potential for exposure to people actually doing work at the mine site? So the first group that we started to work with is the Forest Service, because they have a couple of different locations there, one at Canoe Gulch, which is right on the edge of the Superfund site, and one within town. But they did lots of work within the Forest Service land, which is throughout the Superfund site, along with land owned by Plum Creek. So one of the first studies we did was to collect more samples, and it supported that we were seeing, you know, lots of amphibole in the trees surrounding throughout the mine site. We did a feasibility study with them to assess the exposures that they would encounter doing day-to-day work activities. So things like chopping down trees, hiking through the brush clearing, hiking, and a lot of these activities actually showed that there is a high potential for exposure just doing these day-to-day activities. So the main focus of that side of our research was really working towards protecting those folks that would go on site in areas that we now knew were highly contaminated, messing with the trees or disturbing the asbestos-contaminated trees. Now, concurrently, I've been doing work in Libby since 2003 on an air pollution problem. And that has to do with Libby has high levels of PM2.5, so these are particulates that are floating around in the air. And they're one of the six criteria pollutants regulated by EPA. So Libby was actually found to be non-attainment for PM2.5, a community the size of, 3,000 people?
3,000.
So it's the only community west of the Mississippi River and outside of Southern California that exceeded this air pollution standard. And that includes major metropolitan areas such as Denver and Salt Lake and Houston, Texas, and, you know, major metropolitan areas. So we were contracted by Montana DEQ to figure out what are the sources of PM2.5 in the Libby Valley throughout the winter months. And we collected a lot of samples and analysis, and through a comprehensive modeling program, it showed that wood smoke was the largest source of PM2.5 in Libby throughout the winter months, and the wood smoke coming from wood stoves. So we started putting two and two together. If ever a lot of people have wood stoves in Libby, and there's asbestos contamination in the trees around the mine, you know, is there a relationship there? So that's been kind of the focus of our research for the past several years. One of the projects that we've tackled was going up to the mine site, and this was in collaboration with Forest Service and EPA, to do a firewood harvesting study to determine what is the potential for exposure to harvest firewood. So we dressed up in our suits and went up there in July, in our sweatsuits. You can only imagine how hot it was. And we did a firewood harvesting study, chopping down trees, you know, simulating what somebody would do when they harvest firewood. And the results from that study showed that there is a very high potential for exposure to Libby amphibole when it's hot and dry, especially compared to when we went back up onto the mine site in fall when it was more damp and not as much potential for exposure. So very high potential for exposure harvesting firewood when it was hot and dry. Our next study was to demonstrate what happens to the asbestos when contaminated trees are burned in a wood stove. If most people have a wood stove in Libby, what happens when you actually burn the asbestos contaminated wood? So we did demonstrate that asbestos is actually liberated into the ambient air just doing the three trials that we did using an EPA certified stove. But maybe more importantly, the majority of the asbestos fibers remained in the ash. So that leads to the question of, you know, what do you do when you burn your wood stove? Ash builds up inside your stove, so you sweep it out. So is that a source or a potential for exposure within the homes? And is that a continuing source of exposure, you know, all winter long, winter after winter after winter? And that leads to the question where EPA comes in. If they're spending millions of dollars to clean up these homes, is that just one more way of re-exposure within the homes? So that whole scenario has been kind of the basis of our research for the past 8-9 years now. Mm-hmm. And it just kind of speaks to how complex the issue is, and the more you look, the more you find.
That's great.
Gayla, could you tell us why you think Libby still matters today and why journalists should be paying attention to the story?
Well, if it wasn't for Andy Schneider and the courage of the Seattle PI to take the responsibility of publishing our story, it wouldn't have gotten out. Had the story not gotten out, in the last 11 years, the same people would have become ill, the same people would have died, more families would have lost their homes, been poverty-stricken because they couldn't afford the medications for their COPD that the doctors would have said they had. The news media actually is what has kept this whole story alive. They have held the feet of the agencies to the fire. They have held the government accountable. And at any point in time when this was a very political issue, from the onset, very political. And we were fighting Washington, D.C. The people in Libby were fighting amongst themselves, you might say, and people didn't realize that our fight went all the way to Washington, D.C. and back again, basically because of the enormity of W.R. Grace. And when Greg spoke about the reclassification of the fiber, of the tremolite fiber in the 1970s, I would be willing to bet my firstborn that I could dig through my documents with Grace, and they had something to do with that fiber being reclassified as winchite. I'm just certain of it, because this is just exactly the way the company operated all of these years. They were always ahead of the curve. They were ahead of the agencies. There was never an inspection at the mine, but when there was a 3-day notice to shut down the mine site, to clean up the mine site. But to live there now, there's a lot of lessons that have been learned in Libby. And I think these gentlemen have reiterated each one on how to deal with environmental crime, how to deal with pollution. And prior to the story coming out, asbestos wasn't even talked about. I mean, it was sort of laughingly referred to. Now, every other commercial you see on TV is, do you have mesothelioma? Call me. Well, try calling them sometime, because you say you're from Libby, they hang up. They do. There's no money there. But I think the other lesson is that the government has come in and literally taken over our lives. It's been necessary to do that, though. As far as our medical care has been provided for, and this by W.R. Grace. It's getting ready to do a turnover because the public health emergency, we will go on to Medicare now. But Grace has set the bar, like they did everything else, for our level of medical care for the last 10 years. I mean, they've said, you don't need nighttime oxygen, we will pay for this, but not that. Libby was declared a public health emergency. That's the first time that was ever enacted since this was formed, I believe, in 1973. Really, Libby is probably the biggest learning tool that the United States has got right now on agencies working together, agencies being accountable, getting the job done. On the medical side of it, 400 deaths is a very small number. Definitely, you could double or triple that. But documented, as they say now, they say 400 deaths, so we will stick with that. A decade? No. No, we're looking at another two generations that have been exposed. Hopefully, no one born tomorrow will be exposed to the fiber, but somebody born yesterday very possibly will be. So we're looking at years and years and years. But right now, what they do have treatment for the disease. Both my parents died of the disease, and at that time, there was no treatment for the disease. My mother was the first diagnosed with secondary exposure, which caused her death. She was the only person in the world with this. that she knew of. There was no one to talk to. So up till that point, there was nothing. You only went to the hospital for the symptoms. If you got pneumonia, you would go to the hospital. Since then, we have every level of medical care available, from psychosocial care right down to grassroots medical care. It's all available. The hospitals in Libby are trained for it. We have the Center for Asbestos-Related Disease. We have the research going on. Because the mesothelioma is the only fiber, or the only disease, cancer disease, terminal, that is caused by asbestos. It is like lung cancer was 30 years ago. 30 years ago, if you were diagnosed with lung cancer, you were dead, because it simply was not detectable until it was had amassed itself. Mesothelioma is this way now. But through the CARD clinic, I can't even begin to count the amount of cancers that they have found and pinpointed, the head of a pin, and saved lives by people getting annual screenings. So each one of these things has added to this train wreck that was bound to happen. Had it not happened in Libby, it would have happened over in upstate New York, up in the Iron Range. It would have happened somewhere. I think we were very fortunate that the train wreck happened in Libby because of all of the research, everything that we are learning now about the disease. In the meantime, we have to learn to live and breathe with disease. And I had... I always come prepared to these. I had prepared a bunch of straws. I wanted you all to breathe through a straw while I talked, because that's our world. Well, naturally, they got left in the motel room. But the other thing we have done is we do not have asbestosis. It's asbestos-related disease, because even our fiber is different. Our disease is different. It's not the old standard shipyard asbestosis. We have asbestos-related disease, we live with it, and we die of it. It's not easy living in Libby, because so many of our friends are... It seems like maybe every week I go down to our grocery store and I find somebody new who has been put on oxygen. But still, those people, they're not victims anymore. Since the trial... We became survivors after the trial, and these people are all walking around proudly with their tanks saying, I am still alive, despite the fact, no matter what W.R. Grace did to us or didn't do for us, we are still alive. We're living. We're learning to deal with it. We're teaching the world, really, how to deal with a slow-moving tragedy. We're teaching the world how to deal with a disease, how a whole community really doesn't come together, but they do come together with dealing with the disease, and Libby has a great future. Myself, though, with my family, now my daughter, one of my five children, has been diagnosed. My niece of about the same age has been diagnosed. The youngest person in Libby right now is 29 years old that has been diagnosed. Another 10 years, they will say someone born after 1990 will have the disease, probably. But it's something we simply learn to live with. And we had a car show there, and one of the men was very enterprising. He made T-shirts that said, "We put the fun in Superfund." And I think that's the best way to describe us right now. Life goes on. I mean, it really, he sold out and had to keep getting them reprinted. And I'll get one for Andy. Pink. But no, Libby is always going to be there. There's not much we can do about it. They keep finding more and more of it. They're never going to get it all. So basically what I really play for now is the research. But if it hadn't been for the media, and even today, the media has come back and reviewed this story because they said 10 years ago we wrote this great story and we were wondering what was happening. Every time they come back, there's a different story, there's a different aspect. And if it wasn't for the written word, though, the written word is there, it'll be there forever. A TV newscast is going to be gone.
Let's open it to questions today. And a couple of ground rules before we begin about questions. The SCJ wants us to make sure that members and working journalists have a chance to ask questions first here. We also want to make sure that people aren't making statements. We really are here to ask lots of questions. So I'm opening it to the group. Yes.
Well, EPA has done a nice job of taking some of our... Oh, so how big is the area? I have a sign here that says, please repeat the question asked. So,
and add somebody to tell him.
How big is the area of asbestos contamination around the mine? So for the trees, the map that I saw from EPA, I'll back up. EPA 2 years ago had a really comprehensive sampling program where they collected samples, tree bark samples, and soil and duff samples, which is kind of the tree litter on top of the ground, at various strategic intervals at different directions from the mine site, all the way up to 8 miles in some of the directions. So to answer your question, there is contamination in the data that I saw extending out to 8 miles east of the mine site across Lake Kukanusa. So it actually jumped the big lake, and it's on the other side. There was some directions where there was no detects at the end of their sampling program from the mine. There was other areas and directions from the mine where there was still asbestos detected in the tree bark. So it could have gone out another couple of miles, who knows. But from what I saw, anywhere from 4 to 6 to 8 miles extending from the mine.
Is there any SCJ member? Because I just look at EPA. I'm not SCJ. And I'm curious, I'm in the office in Philadelphia, but how do you feel EPA dealt with the citizens? Were you well informed?
How do I feel about the EPA? And well, I'm optimistic. My attitude is they work for us. And I think they're only as good as the people that keep their feet to the fire. And insofar as Libby, we've had some really good years. We've had some really rough years with the EPA, basically because of Washington, D.C. I mean, it's like I say, this has been a political issue. I would say overall, though, I think the people that are sent to us are committed 110%. And the biggest thing that has held them back are the directives that they have gotten out of Region 8 in Washington, D.C. to back off on some of their investigating. But insofar as 90% of the people that have been sent to Libby, they have really given their all. They have become very, very emotionally involved with the situation, and I am very satisfied.
Do they have things, you know, in Region 3 community involvement coordinators that are stay in the area and keep you informed how the cleanup's going?
Yes, they do. They have the community involvement coordinators. The information, they have the office set up right there. They did have a citizens advisory group that was ongoing for about 9 years, but it got to the point where it really wasn't a place to distribute information. So now they still have the technical assistance group that meets. The EPA is present there to distribute information. And then you're always welcome one-on-one to receive information, and there are press releases. So at any point, anyone can find out exactly what is going on and what they're going to do.
Yes.
I'm Kenton Bird from the University of Idaho, and I'd like to hear the panel talk a little bit more about the media coverage, especially at the beginning. And I'm curious as to why it took the Seattle's Post-Intelligencer more than 400 miles away from Libby to come break this story. Where was the Montana press?
Everybody hear the question? Where was the Montana press?
Yeah.
Well, I can't answer that part of it, okay?
An angel drops you.
Sometimes it's extremely difficult to see the fire smoldering right in front of you. I can't tell you why the PI stayed on this story, other than the fact that nobody else was. I mean, I assure you that when we started getting real proof that there was a problem, when Gayla stopped yapping and actually started telling us what she knew, and we took our own soil samples and determined they were hot as hell, we realized there was a significant problem. And we talked to other environmental reporters and said, you know, I mean, Denver had some The Rocky Mountain News has some great environmental reporters. They care about Montana. Why didn't you do this? Why didn't we do what? I never heard of it. So I can't tell you why, other than I was very fortunate. I had a newspaper that really cared about public health issues, and since nobody else was doing it, we did it.
Maybe I could respond to the story, because I was watching at that time too, and I remember hearing from a university official whose family had asbestos-related diseases, called me and said, you know, there's a bunch of stuff going on in Libby. There's a lot of lawsuits up there, and this is in September of 1999 that I first heard this story, that it was up there, and immediately did what most journalists would do and got on and Googled, and, well, precursor of Google, but I looked for all sorts of different places, and there was nothing. I couldn't believe it. It was almost stunning to find that there was not much coverage. A little blip in the local newspaper of a procedural step in a civil suit, but no background, no idea of the exposure to this story. And I think Montana papers really didn't pay much attention. Libby's relative isolation to the population centers, I think, played into that a little bit. I think there was also this sort of inevitable emotional aspect in Montana and a lot of states that rely on sort of rural extractive industries, that these kind of occupations, mining, agriculture, logging, are inherently dangerous, and you're going to have people who are going to get hurt. And what Gayla says to that, and she can answer it better than I can, is that people didn't realize the collateral, I hate the word, collateral damage that was going on as a result of what was going on there too. So I think there was not a good history in Montana of an aggressive press dealing with mining and occupational diseases. Butte, Montana, had more silicosis cases than a lot of other places in the state. It never got much recognition in this state or much official response. So there was a history of not covering these issues as well, and that's my comment.
Rising to the defense of my Montana colleagues, I need to tell you, this was a spooky story. Even when we found there was asbestos all over the place, and Gayla didn't speak with a forked tongue, it made no sense that many people, those hundreds of people, could have been sickened or killed, and no one knew about it. There were no cancer clusters showing us this. There were no CDC. I mean, we spent a lot of time, and the only way we got into it was eventually getting to all the tertiary centers in the Northwest and getting them to at least talk about numbers, not patients. And at that point, we knew it was a solid issue that had to be pursued.
Part of the problem locally, we had five civil trials held in Libby against W.R. Grace. And these were probably the most important trials to be held anywhere in the United States. The press never showed up. The only people who would show up would be victims, and they would watch these trials. But we were warned that if the press was to publish anything about these trials, the trials would immediately be moved. Grace had made this proclamation to the judge. If there was any press coverage, the trials would be moved. Most of these people that were coming to trial were too sick to travel somewhere else. But that was the big threat. W.R. Grace set the bar, absolutely set the bar. And I think if anyone had even come to town, if Andy had just come to town and talking, if he ran into the wrong people on the street, they'd say there isn't a problem. There was a buffer zone out there that was protecting this mine, because this company bought and paid for Libby. They provided anything Libby wanted. I mean, they provided the baseball uniforms and all of the equipment, and they maintained the fields for the children to play on. The only problem is there was an expanding plant directly adjacent to the field, and those children are now ill.
I just want to add one more media point, okay? And Gayla, my life will be ruined with her from this point on. But I need to tell you, Grace wasn't the only one being protective. There was a group of lawyers in Kalispell that really worked their heart out on civil litigation for these victims. I give them that hands down. However, they wanted to spoon feed the release of information. When I first documented this and realized it was an issue, I went to one of the lawyers, and the reality was, I'm waiting for the New York Times. I'm waiting, right?
Yeah.
I'm waiting for the New York Times. Why would I deal with the Seattle PI? I want the Times to come do this. So, I mean, you know, it was obfuscated on all sorts of weird levels.
Can I add into that and connect back to the question that the gentleman from the EPA asked? And that is that lots of people knew lots of information. W.R. Grace knew a ton of information, but so did the government. The government knew a ton of information. The state knew a ton of information. And one wonders where those organizations were. We saw in the trial a lot of EPA's communications used against itself, right? Used against the government. Even the minutes from the community action group were being introduced in the trial by the defense against the government, right? So that relationship that the regulators have to the regulated is very perilous. And we saw it over and over again. I mean, I think Gail is dead on that W.R. Grace was way ahead of everybody else about the definition of asbestos. Mm-hmm. They knew. They were actively working on how that was going to be regulated. They understood the far-reaching implications of this stuff. And they were, I think, giving information. So I don't think you can just point to the media. I think the media, it's critical to say where was the media. But I think we also learned in the trial that EPA bears some responsibility to the entire picture, and just on a broader picture of that question of we have administrative agencies to regulate industry, and how does that relationship really work, and does it always benefit the public?
But everything you say is accurate as usual. However, broaden it just for a little bit. Yes, EPA headquarters knew precisely what was going on. There were hundreds of documents showing tests in Libby, test of Libby products that went back 20 years. The people in Region 8 that were being sent up to solve this problem or make it disappear didn't know about it. I was with them when some researcher came in and said, "You're not going to believe this." I mean, these guys were devastated for the very reasons you talk about. So when we talk about the agencies not doing their things, we need to at least think. I would request us to at least think about the agencies, the individuals involved. I mean, one of the things that came up either from Tony or Greg was, I'm older than dirt, and I've covered lots of government intervention in crisis. This is the first time I've seen this level of interagency cooperation without most of the political backstabbing. This was an amazing thing. And it was an amazing thing because traditionally, let's just take EPA, when they send people out to look at a leak, at a crisis, at polluted water, the risks are on the come. Someday people may have birth defects. Someday people may have cancer. This was the first time that that emergency response team that showed up in Libby actually had victims. Gala took them to the cemetery. People they got to know died. People they became close to died. It had an amazing impact on these, quote, bureaucrats who were seeing their laws being implemented in a way that didn't save these people, and it became very personal for them. So, yes, the overall structure of the government really dropped the ball on Libby. But the individual, many of the individuals from all the agencies that went out there and met the people, can't question their dedication.
Can I just jump in?
I want to go back to legal changing the name of marijuana.
And I want to jump in just quickly after you.
Okay. But just to follow up on what you said, because of Libby, there is now a federal interagency asbestos working group that meets once a year, talks about these issues. It's EPA, NIOSH, OSHA, CDC, ATSDR, USGS, we all get together and talk about all of these problems that have come up since 2000. And hopefully we're moving forward and trying to get solutions. The NIOSH roadmap is on asbestos research has been a product from this interagency work that came from Libby. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have two explanations, though, for the situation in Libby happening. And one was, like you said, W.R. Grace was way light years ahead of the curve. And a document that I usually show on presentations as an A through G, where they waited for Ronald Reagan to be put into office and things would change for the better. All of the documents Andy talked about were at the EPA office. Ronald Reagan came into office and it appointed a committee to cut down environmental spending, or cut down government spending, and appointed J. Peter Grace as the head of it. Everything stopped at that point. Everything stopped at that point. The second thing, and I blame the community of Libby. I truly do, because even the hospital, the doctors were not allowed to speak about someone coming in and dying of asbestos-related disease. We had two doctors that were run out of town, literally run out of town on a rail, because they saw the problem in Libby, the mesotheliomas and the workers coming in and so sick, and the hospital ran them out. Why? Because Earl Lubbock was chairman of the board of directors of the hospital, and he was second in command at W.R. Grace. Libby's hands were tied. You couldn't talk to a doctor in that town and get an honest answer. So if the press was to come to town and try to talk to anybody, unless they saw someone on oxygen, and 9 chances out of 10 that person wouldn't talk to them either, because if they had made a settlement, an out-of-court settlement, which Grace made hundreds in the 80s, if they had gotten an out-of-court settlement, they were afraid Grace would come back and take their money if they even spoke about it. So, really, Grace, absolutely. I really feel that Grace had such a stronghold, and I think this is another thing for lessons to be learned, is to show how a corporation can use us as collateral damage for greed and literally manipulate a whole community into this isolation that we had.
Saw a question over there?
Yes.
Don, hope you can post that at Pittsburgh. What kind of disconnect do you see, or did you see, between the environmental and health agencies on the state and national level? Because I think there's still a major problem there. The environmental agencies really don't know what's going on health-wise in some of these communities. You mentioned a lack of cancer clusters. Working on a couple of stories right now that the state Department of Health in Pennsylvania isn't looking for cancer clusters, or they're not asking the right questions to find the cancer clusters. They don't want to find the cancer clusters almost. They're comparing death rates for certain diseases to the same death rates in other parts of the state instead of comparing them to national rates. I mean, so they don't see, there's not a blip on their radar, because their radar is like scanning the ocean over here instead of over here.
It exists all over the country, Don. I mean, it's not new. It's unfortunate that the agencies most responsible for health analysis often wait until the public outcry is made. I went back a few years ago and sort of tracked what triggered concerns, health concerns about issues, about communities, and it was almost always the EPA or a local group. There are some wonderful state health departments, but sometimes they buckle under the corporate mentality that Gayla was talking about. I mean, Gayla said if it wasn't Libby, it was going to be someplace else. Well, someplace else might be the Iron Range that goes through northern Minnesota and Michigan. They pull taconite out of the mines there. Taconite's lousy with tremolite. But the politics of having these enormous employers that run all the mines sort of stifles these discussions. I mean, I've gotten really frustrated calls from health department people saying, what the hell do we do? I know we've got mesothelioma all over the place here. We can't do anything about it. They refer us. Our agency makes us go to the Mayo Clinic, and they've got occupational medicine people. Unfortunately, they're all on grants from the same mining companies. So I don't know how you get away from it. It's got to be people like you and the other journalists that make the light so damn bright that it's really hard to ignore it.
But it's to follow up, it's almost as though we have to wait for, if it's not the media, certainly community groups to do the work that I would think agencies, environmental agencies, should be doing in terms of connecting the dots. Yes, this is an environmental issue. Is it also a health issue? They don't seem to do that connector there.
You're right. And I don't know how you get around it. I mean, there was a federal EPA employee in Montana that knew some of what was going on at Libby long before we wrote the story. And he's never granted me an interview, so I don't know why he never passed it along. The state people here or in Helena really seemed to have a clue that there was something happening, but they've got a desk filled with projects, with crisis, each one worse than the other. I mean, there's 1,000 excuses everyone uses, and some of them are really valid. But, you know, you're an officer in this group here. Just look back over the last X number of years and see how many major health investigations were sparked by your members. It shouldn't be that way. We shouldn't have to be, you know, we shouldn't have to be the cops on these things. But if there's nobody else doing it, then we have to make an effort, right?
Somebody else want to respond to the question about state and local?
No, I guess one thing, making a link between environmental exposures and the health effects, sometimes it takes a lot of money and a lot of time and to pay for the expertise for people to look at these projects. And like was said, you know, their pile of projects to look at is this high on their desk, and each one of them can take years and years and years. So sometimes the issue gets buried under the stack of other projects that need to be looked at.
I think the other aspect of this too, even in Helena, if this subject came up, it was pretty well muffled to the agencies. Every ton of ore that was shipped from Libby, the state received a tax on it and the county received a tax. It was a big money maker for both. And therefore it was stifled. I mean, really. And Grace paid well.
I remember seeing some memos in the civil cases that were from the State Board of Health people that knew about what was going on, and they were staffed confidential.
Yeah, 1957.
And mining officials saw them, but I didn't even know that information got to the unions.
Yeah, it didn't get to the media. Actually, I gave this information to Andy. It was all in the courthouse, though. The students that went down found it. 5 years it sat in the courthouse from the trials, and I had copies of all of it. And when Andy and I finally started speaking to each other, oh, it was nasty. I'll tell you, it was nasty. I send them to Italian restaurants.
This is sort of tangentially connected to that, but what you mentioned, the people that are being grant-funded at the Mayo Clinic by the mine, I struggle a lot because, not as a journalist, I get frustrated when I see the need for the objectivity, so we've got to have the other side respond. And what I see that is industry understands that, funds a study that says, you know what, BPA, that's not a problem. And then you've got this other study that says it is, and then you have to quote both of them. And where are we? And, I mean, ask Greg what it was like to testify in the trial. I mean, the defense attacked every single issue and every piece of science, because you could always say, there's another side of that story. And that, I think, is a challenge for journalists, how you ever get through to get the information to say, we really do have a public health issue here, and, you know, we can't just sort of gloss it over on a 50-50.
it's a really valid point. And maybe Don or the other journalists in the room have a way to get around it. I can't. I've got to put both sides in.
Right.
If we don't do it, we'll get crucified. We at least have to let the other side, whatever that is, have its say. And then we can either show where it's false, or we can overwhelm them with other information that we believe to be more credible. But we don't have that opportunity. And you're right, corporations are masterful at loading the deck with questionable science. And we all encounter that, don't we? And, you know, I get criticized at times because I spend a lot of time talking to government scientists and government investigators. And while there are some vested interests all over the place because they're human, for the most part, those are my most credible sources. If they can show me the science, if they can explain how they did it, and tell me why I should believe them, then I'm comfortable going with that as a starting point. The balance, you got to give them. I mean, you wouldn't believe the collection of notes I have from Grace saying we were only mentioned 4 times in that story. You know, that didn't have the word bastard in front of it, but I mean, it was like.
John Adams has a question back there.
Yeah, real quick, and this I think ties in nicely with both of these questions. Libby isn't the first town to have a public health emergency. It's not going to be the last.
It is the first.
Well, technically, but.
Declared a public health emergency.
Other places have had major issues like this, mm-hmm. not quite like this, but this isn't the first time, more or less. How do journalists find these things when you are dealing with companies that are trying to keep the lid on it, agencies that aren't maybe talking about it, communities that are trying to protect the largest employer, that sort of thing? I mean, how do we go out and seek out these stories and find?
Sorry, I'm deaf as a rock. He has to repeat the question.
How do journalists find these stories that when there's so many vested interests at keeping them hid?
Yeah.
I knew.
How do journalists find these stories when there's so many interests against keeping them, or interests trying to keep them?
How do we find these types of stories? I mean, the simple answer, and I'm not trying to be flippant, is if something doesn't make sense to you, then you should look at it. I mean, that's pretty much what I've done on virtually every story I've ever done. I'm not brilliant. I don't have a crystal ball. But when I see something that doesn't make sense, I want to know why. And that clearly was the issue with Libby and many of the other stories. How in the hell can hundreds of people be killed and thousands more sickened, and, you know, there aren't flags flying everywhere? Does that answer your question? I couldn't hear much of what you said, so.
Well, I guess the question is, this gentleman, I think, rightly pointed out that the Montana media was following a paper that was 400 miles away on this story, but I think part of that is it's possible that the Montana media weren't aware of it in some cases, but not just Libby. If I wanted to go out and make sure that something like this isn't happening somewhere else, where do you start? What are the things that you look for, the signals, the triggers, the clues that there's a serious problem? Or do you need a tipster?
Okay.
I think you follow the plaintiff's attorneys.
You do.
I'm serious. I mean, the plaintiff's attorneys are often way ahead because people are getting sick and they're going to lawyers, and they're trying to get some remedy for them. And there were lots of civil trials before any of this came up. Mm-hmm. In the national press.
When we had some grad students that were working on this story about the same time, and when they went to the district court in Lincoln County and they looked and they asked about the record, they were shown a room with boxes and boxes and boxes of stuff on this. There were 90 different cases. And they were told, the clerks told them, "We were expecting you. What took you so long?"
I'd like to comment on that too, though. Is as journalists, you really should try to think ahead of the curve. I've got an issue, and you know, maybe hopefully 20 years from now, it's not going to come true. But Milltown Dam was taken out, correct? There was arsenic behind it. Now, did they dip all the arsenic out of the water? All right, 20 years from now, if that goes downriver, where is it going to end up? The next dam is at Thompson Falls. And it'll destroy, it'll pollute their water. So these are things I think I've got this mind that doesn't sleep at night. I'm always thinking ahead of the curve. And this really does bother me. But there's instances like that all over the state of Montana. Anytime you've got an old abandoned mine, you've got a groundwater problem, anything like that, check on it. I mean, just check on it and ask a question. But if you get the same deadhead answer three times, go for a fourth time. Because somewhere out there, there's somebody that is thinking ahead of the curve, too. And I really hate to disclaim this beautiful thing that they're doing out here. But by the same token, you know, that does bother me because of Libby.
Ray?
Just wanted to help answer that question in my way and then ask a question. You can do a lead check if this is your lead, of course, you're going to identify this is the lead, and call public health officials. And the higher up you go, the less local knowledge they have, the more centralized the knowledge is. So county, state level, EPA, both state or EPA region, try to develop relationships with sources. You can also do what Gayla says. You imagine where the problem's going to be. You know a certain kind of plant is handling a certain kind of material. You can try to find out where there's a problem there. And I'm sure the agencies track materials in some way. It's spotty, but you can try to find hot spots before they flare up. So you can anticipate. It's all time intensive, and you've got to be dealing with things to make the difference. So, perfect world, that's what we can do. But I'd like Dennis to talk about a little bit about the role of the J School here. I rarely hear that mentioned, and in my mind, that was the first piece journalistically on moving this to public awareness.
Well, all I will say is that we'd heard a tip from a university official who said there was all these cases up there and we should go take a look. And we had a couple of graduate students who had nothing better to do or looking for something to do, and they went up there and took a look too. But they did run into many of the problems that Gail and Andrew mentioned. The attorneys didn't want to talk to them. They were fearful that their clients would lose settlements. The doctor who knew most about the cases didn't want to talk to them, and some of that's natural. These were students. They had notebooks, and they're the most frightening thing in the world to a lot of people. When they first get started, they're asking questions, who are you? Where are you from? How do I know I can trust you? So they were running into all those kinds of barriers, too, but they kept working on the story. But I do think Andrew's work really, really was the springboard for just about every piece of work that was going on. And one of the things that I admired most about his work was the fact that he did his own testing, and that paper paid for that. They could show the links. They sent Andrew to all these places to look at the death certificates and then talk to the doctor, because the death certificates don't always tell you exactly what people die of. So that extra kind of research is really important to me. And that's the kind of research I'm concerned about right now being done. And we're trying to train students here so that universities can actually do some of that journalism too. But I worry about what's going to happen when organizations don't have the resource to do all the stuff that Andy did to make that story so successful.
I mean, Dennis brings up a very painful point. You'll crank out some really brilliant journalists from this university, and they'll get to newsrooms, and they'll be, you want to spend what to test what? I mean, I was very fortunate at this small newspaper in Seattle. My publisher cared a hell of a lot about public health and would reach into his pocket. And we spent tens of thousands of dollars testing a range of products. And the story I tell very briefly was we knew there was talc in crayons. We knew that talc from Vanderbilt mines were loaded with asbestos. We wanted to test it. We did. We tested 8 crayons. We tested 15 brands from around internationally that were being sold in the U.S. Narrowed it down to 4 that really had high levels. One of them was Crayola, American apple pie, all that. Went to my publisher and I said, look, we want to run this story. We tested 8 colors. We need to go. He says, but don't they have boxes with 64 colors in it? And does it differ from color to color? I mean, you know, this gentleman is dead now. Unfortunately, that type of journalism is becoming more and more prone to becoming obsolete. It has to be done. I mean, I now work for AOL News, a multi-billion dollar operation. I desperately need to test some food products. And the very concept of saying I'll hold it down, I just need $8,000. And I can hear his eyes roll over the phone, you know. I can't do this story because FDA isn't doing the testing. Nobody else is. I can't run this story, and it's a story that should be run because it's a public health issue. I don't know whether my new employer is going to reach down and pay for this testing. So the graduates that you put out, brilliant journalists they are already, are going to face this wall, and it's really hard.
We need to find better ways at places like this to assist that kind of work, too. We are, it's 10:25, we're 15 minutes past the end time. I'm sorry to have to cut this short, but I want to thank everybody for coming and give a big hand to our panelists.